Podcast.
As you can hear already, we're doing this over Skype, and
Yeah, I got sick of looking at your face.
it's I thought nothing could stop the Comicast, but turns out a little rain could.
Soon we'll be like one of those rock bands, like the Stranglers or something. They all live, like 200 miles apart, and they record albums by like just recording bits and then sending it to one another. So I'll record my bits of the Comicast, and then I'll send it to you, and you can fill in your bits, so we never have to speak.
That's great. I bet that's what Simon and Garfunkel started to do near the end.
Oh, definitely, definitely, But anyway, we're not here to talk about Simon and Garfunkel as much as I might like to. We're here to talk about Alan Nolan, Ireland's number one comic creator of all time. Right?
Yes.
Is that
Yeah, that
correct?
is correct. And and as is the case, he's got loads of new comics out with O'Brien Press. So I went to talk to him about him.
All right, okay, we're here back in the Central Hotel. We haven't been here in quite a while, and I'm here with Alan Nolan to talk about his new series of books that have come out from O'Brien Press, and Death by Chocolate, which we reviewed on our last show, is out now, and The Big Break Detectives will be out by the time you hear this show. How's it all going?
Oh, it's gone great, yeah. I'm delighted with the way it's gone so far. Death by Chocolate now has been out since the middle of or the end of August, so I believe the sales are good, and it's a great thrill going into bookshops and seeing it, in the kids section there. So the second in that series is out on Monday, I think. It's called 6 Million Ways to Die. It's a totally standalone story. It doesn't have the same Petit Pois character or the chimp, whose name momentarily eludes me. Tesla. It
Tesla.
doesn't. You think I know this? I wrote these jokes, but yeah, it's a totally different time travel story. So
Okay.
it's very science fictiony and very and science fiction is what I love, So I'm delighted to be doing that one.
It seems like in the Murder Can Be Fatal series that with each of how many is there in total?
Well, there's four planned.
Right.
There's Death by Chocolate, 6 Million Ways to Die. The third one is called Destination Homicide, and that's out next year. That's going to be another sort of science fiction thing. I'm actually putting superheroes in this one, which
Okay.
is cool. They'll
Yeah,
be in
yeah.
a very supporting role. It's going to be about two cops, buddy buddy cop kind of thing, one fat and one small sort of cops. And then the fourth one is called And the Blood Flowed Green, which is totally science fiction. It's going to be like I think I was telling you before. It's going to be like Brendan Behan meets Flann O'Brien in space. So
It's a great premise.
And they're all murder mystery sort of things. You always have to find out who the murderer is.
Yeah,
So
yeah. And even it seems with each individual book, despite there being a murder in each one, you really are getting the chance to kind of explore really different,
genres
genres.
and
Exactly, yeah.
yeah. Well, in the idea behind the Murder Can Be Fatal ones is that I would take different detective genres and genres in general, I suppose, and kind of mix them together. So the first one, Death by Chocolate, is a mixture of, and all these genres are stuff that I love. So the first one was Agatha Christie meets Tintin. So you have the Petit Pois character would be a sort of Agatha Christie amalgam sort of thing, and then Tesla is a little bit like Snowy in that they're
I really got
clever
that.
and she narrates the story, so she's kind of speaking in her own head the way Snowy would in the Tintin books. The second one then is kind of like I don't know, like Logan's Run and the Bionic Man meets Back to the Future. So he has to go back into the he's it's about a stuntman who's in a terrible terribly injured during a stunt, and I always like the Fall Guy as well, like all these Lee Majors things all mixed together. It's a one-eyed stuntman who maybe that's why he crashed. He's trying to jump a canyon in a dragster. He's like an Evel Knievel sort of stuntman. Daredevil stuntman, and he is in a terrible crash. And 6 months later, he wakes up to find that the whole world has changed. that Japan won the Second World War. It's all set in America. Japan won the Second World War, and so even the notes have the Emperor Hirohito or whatever on them, and like the flag, the American flag is a rising sun where the star should be, and all this kind of stuff. So, and he also realizes that he's been made biotronic. He's a cyborg now. It's almost like, you know, this Terminator kind of scene where he's kind of ripping off the skin, and you can see the metalwork underneath. So he decides to that, you know, this doesn't suit him, obviously, because he's the only person here in that reality who realizes that that the timeline has been changed. So he does a bit of research and finds out that it all happened when the Titanic didn't sink. So he has to go back in time using a handy dandy time machine that just happens to be hanging around. Now, there's a big backstory to explain all this, and goes back to the Titanic, and he has to solve a series of murders on the Titanic. So it's a bit of fun. It was a challenge for me drawing the bloody Titanic, because this is the second book in a row that I've put ships in. I can't draw boats. I've learned how to draw them.
Artists always have like this one thing, you know, it's like feet, or it's, you know, something crazy that just
I'm actually not bad at feet. Hands, right. I'm reasonably all right at, but the things I can't draw are horses, dogs, and boats. So the third book, the one I'm writing at the moment, is Destination Homicide, and that's gone on a kind of funny tangent while I'm writing it, and it's sort of gone back to, I have a big backstory that's set in the American Civil War, and my editor Helen Carr in O'Brien Press said, "Oh great, we're going to get loads of horses," and I said, "No, you're not getting any horses."
No, just like invent some like new plot twist where there aren't horses, that they use some other animal, you know,
exactly,
instead.
Yeah, well, it kind of is like that. It's sort of it's the Civil War, but it's all about the naval Civil War, where you had the old battleship.
But that's got boats.
Yeah. Well, there you are, but they don't really look like boats. They're kind of battleships called ironclads. So they sat really low in the water, and all you could see was the kind of pyramid shape, almost a long pyramid, almost like a stealth bomber. You know the American stealth bombers at the moment? With loads of little canopies to open up and cannons to come out. I just thought they were cool looking. So, and also that the American Civil War was the first time, I believe, that submarines were used in an experimental capacity in warfare. So I've worked in a sort of ironclad submarine, and it's going to be a nice scene to draw. I'll put it like that, you know. I really should stay away from boats and water.
Well, speaking of drawing, how long since, obviously on the square bound panel, we heard you talking how you had gone to try and contact O'Brien Press, and they had tried to contact you at the same time. You'd actually cross paths. But so once you started with O'Brien Press, like, how long did it take you to work on these books? Because, I mean, beside Declan Shalvey, you're like one of the most, you know, just knocking out these comics, you know.
Yeah, I think the first contact I had with O'Brien Press was late July of last year. So when I was contracted to do the I think it was six books in total, six or seven books in total. Jeez, I can't even remember that. I met up with them, or I had a phone call with them first of all straight away. And they said, come in with a few ideas. So I had the Sancho book that I was bringing into them. And I thought, well, I have a few ideas, all right, that I've kind of been thinking of for children's books. You see, the thing with Sancho is it's sort of almost for grown-ups. it's pitched at, you know, the kind of comic people, you know, the normal sort of denizens of Forbidden Planet and Sub-City and so on. You know, it's kind of pitched at them, or pitched at myself, really. But I knew O'Brien's were more into kind of kids publishing. They do. They publish fiction for children and non-fiction books for adults and children. Mm-hmm. So I thought, you know, Sancho mightn't be something they go for, really. And plus, in the phone conversation I had with Michael O'Brien, he really liked a cartoon strip I'd done for the Irish Times, which is all about the World Cup. And kids who get to play in a match in the World Cup. Like, it's totally off the wall sort of story, but he liked the style of it, and he liked the colouring, and he liked the little neat story that it started and ended, and, you know, had made sense instead of sort of non sequitur sort of thing. which usually works better in books, you know? yeah, have a beginning, middle, and end. So he asked me to come in and bring a few ideas. So I sat down and I had a couple of ideas already for things I was going to pitch to various publications. So I kind of sat down and refined those a little bit and wrote a synopsis for each of the books and did a few character sketches, like very quick on lined paper. Sort of, you know, went into my 11-year-old son and said, "Give me that copy." Ripped out the middle pages and drew a little bit and scanned it. I brought those in, and I think I brought in about 8 or 9 ideas, and maybe not that many. But they went for 6 of them, which was fantastic. Mm-hmm. And 3 of them, or 4 of them, sorry, we decided to put into a little series because they all had kind of. They were totally different stories, but they were all about murder. Like, I have this thing about, you know, I love the detective shows of the 80s and the 70s and Starsky and Hutch and all that kind of stuff. Rockford Files especially. I just love that show. So I had been watching a lot of those on DVD, like the sad get that I am, like ordering off Amazon and so on, and sitting there until 3 o'clock in the morning, my poor wife, you know, lying in her cold, cold, lonely, lonely bed, going, "We're selling them. Why am I hearing the sound of screeching tires from downstairs?" But I decided that, you know, that I'd come up with mostly crime ideas, so I came in with Death by Chocolate and a few others, and I actually had the names for them at that stage, and I had the character names and had the character sketches and had a little synopsis of what was going to happen in the story. Now, between that synopsis and what actually happens in Death by Chocolate, it's nearly completely different, but that's by the by. And the same happens for all the stories. They kind of develop, you know, from the original idea.
Yeah.
But he loved those ideas, and they loved the idea for... I think I was telling you before about Oisín's 11 that became Fintan's 15, worst hurley team in the world. And I'm going to try and get that one out next year as well. That was a little sports story that isn't science fiction. It isn't crime, and it's just a nice little story.
Yeah, yeah.
So I'm gonna work on that one next year. And the other idea he liked was the Big Break Detectives casebook, which is also coming out on the 26th this month. Now that one is a story about 3 kids who go to national school and they escape at lunchtime. Well, escape. They get out. They have a secret base under the school where they have a little detective agency. They escape during lunchtime, which is half an hour, usually in national schools, and they solve a mystery and then come back by the half 12 bell. It's a casebook. There's 4 different stories in it, and I had about 6 or 8 of these stories. And we kind of, you know, picked out 4 of them that we thought would work as one book. And I got one of the characters to narrate the whole story. And I'll just tell you about the beginning of this book. It actually started out as a cartoon strip I was doing for ReRaw magazine.
Oh, yes.
Comic. That's Aidan Courtney is the editor of that. And I was really enjoying doing that. It's an Irish language comic. And they started out as, you know, 4 and 6 page stories in that. I had 2 of them in ReRaw. And how that works is I'd write the stories and sketch them up and then give the script to Aidan, who'd pass it on to a translator who'd translate it into Irish and then give it back to me. And then I'd put the lettering in the strip. So the trick was to leave enough room, you know, in the boxes.
Because,
well, the English, it could be, you know, "Oh, I'm going down the stairs now." But it is 4 times that length in Irish by the time you spell it out in length. So the trick was leaving enough space. And I don't really speak Irish at all. And I should. It's terrible. But especially since I have 2 kids. We're learning Irish at the moment. And they're asking me to help with their homework. And I'm going, "Tá sé ní mhoracú."
You could just pass on your comic too.
I don't know. I pass on the comic, yeah. But they're not really... they're not really that smart. I think they got the Nolan gene for the old learning Irish. That's where the idea came from.
Right.
And I brought that to Michael, and he thought they were great characters and great ideas. So what I did was I expanded the 2 stories that we had, and I came up with another about 8 or 9 stories. we came up with new characters to go into it. For instance, they have a sort of Seven's Arc 7 robot that's back in their base in the old laboratory science lab underneath the school where they operate from. And he was left, but you know, he's built 30 years ago and left by an old science teacher who's retired. And he was kind of, when they found him, he was dusty and, you know, hanging down like this and cobwebs coming off him. And they opened him up, or, you know, started him up again, rebooted him. And he's a cranky old get of a robot, a really judgmental sort of real sniffy. A bit like if you know Magnum, you know Higgins and Magnum.
I don't.
He was the kind of English boss, almost like a landlord that Tom Selleck had. You know, Tom Selleck was off doing his private investigators. He'd come back and there'd be the sniffy Englishman. Now, Percy the robot isn't particularly English, but he's got that sniffy sort of hard done by chip on his shoulder.
Yeah.
As you would if you're stuck for 30 years, you know, in the dust and gloom. But I added a lot of characters to it and came up with new stories and redrew the ones that were in Re-Raw. And added the new characters into it and rewrote them a bit. And then I have the linking narration is told in journal style. So it's little Tom, who's one of the characters, has written in his own handwriting all the... so it's almost like, you know, Diary of a Wimpy Kid, where he writes out, you know, what happened. So he's commenting on the cartoon stories that are in there.
Yeah.
So he's commenting on the comic strip and saying, well, that was great, wasn't it? Or wasn't he in Egypt? Or Well, not as crass as that. It's actually quite witty. I can't remember what he says that's witty at the moment.
It looks great. I mean, those actually pages kind of jumped out at me. The fact that, you know, you'd open it up and it kind of looks like a desk and it's got like pencils and, different things, you know, on it. It really adds to it, I think.
Yeah, I've gone for this kind of the approach that it actually is a real journal. And even on the cover, I've kind of put a spiral binding. It's like, it's not a real spiral binding. Yeah. There's a fake spiral binding down the side. And it's full of, you know, jelly babies and licorice all sorts and little wrapped up sweets and... This kid, he's meant to be like a typical... He's actually based on my son, Matthew.
Okay.
And what I did with him was I took photos of Matthew in different poses and with different facial expressions and just kind of copied those for the facial expressions that I used throughout the book. But it goes off on tangents on the in-between bits when he's commenting on the mysteries or on the cases, and he tells how they got together and he tells how they found the laboratory and how they deal with Percy the robot, and also goes into great detail about his favourite 70s show, which is sort of... I was watching Starsky and Hutch recently and I realised that little Tom's favourite show was actually Starsky and Hutch in disguise. It's called Ham and Pickle, Masters of Disguise. And it's about two guys, two detectives who are, you know, sent out on undercover missions the whole time. And, like, they're just really unsuited to undercover missions because they always look like themselves. Like, one has a huge, big handlebar moustache. And even when he's playing a woman in the underclass, you know, he could be a nanny, you know, and he'd have the huge moustache. And then the big guy is sitting in the pram with his legs hanging out and a rattle in his hand. So it was a bit of fun doing all that kind of stuff. And then... You know, I decided, well, if he's really into this Ham and Pickle TV program, then there must be loads of Ham and Pickle memorabilia. So I did, like, cola chew bars with the Ham and Pickle logo and moustache kits and disguise kits and all this kind of stuff. So it was a load of work, but a load of fun.
Yeah, it must be. I mean, as we were even saying about Murder Can Be Fatal series as well, they're loaded with pop culture references. So you must be, like... well, I guess like everybody, but a complete like nerd for like, you know, old TV shows and, you know, 80s movies and...
Oh yeah, I love them. I think my taste got stuck in the 80s. when I sit down to watch something on the TV or a DVD, my default setting is, you know, something from the 80s. So it's either Ferris Bueller's Day Off or Back to the Future trilogy or something like that. You know, I'm just huge 80s nut.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think because, you know, I was growing up, I was a child during the 80s, basically. And I collected all the Star Wars figures and I collected all the, you know, Ghostbusters figures and not so much Transformers. My brother was a huge Transformers nut, but not me. But yeah, I just, and like, they're still in the attic. You know, this is stuff that I haven't sold on eBay in dark times.
Too valuable.
You know, too valuable. Stuff that was too valuable is still in the attic.
And the other thing about the Big Break Detectives is it's full color. So, like, how difficult or you know is it to go about coloring like the drawing and coloring the book? I presume you did color the book.
Oh, I did. Yeah.
So, like, that's a lot more work.
Yeah, it was a lot of work, but I'm such a bloody control freak. I couldn't hand it over. And I had a few offers of people who said, you know, oh, we'll help you out with the color. I was like, yeah, I'll get back to you. And I never did because well, for one thing, there was the whole journal page thing where I have all the little sweets and inserts and little poems and, you know, post-it notes stuck in. I kind of knew I wanted to do that myself.
Right.
So if I was doing that, I may as well do the whole thing.
Yeah.
But to be honest, it was like 3 o'clock in the morning stops for about 2 months. You know, it was a hell of a lot of work because I'm a graphic designer. I'm self-employed, but I have to work during the day and I have to do the work when it comes in. So I was trying to keep the book work to, you know, say 3 o'clock or 3 in the afternoon and go, right, that's enough work, onto the books and get working on that. But, you know, you're putting on a full day on the books as well as your, you know, more or less a full day on your actual paid money work, that you're going to get the money in quickly for.
You say there, like, you know, being a control freak, and I'm curious about the collaboration with, you know, with having an editor.
Oh yeah.
You know, and how that relationship worked.
Oh, it worked out beautifully. On the Big Break Detectives, my editor Mary was fantastic. Like she really liked the book, I think, to start with. So she went through it and there were very few changes that she gave me. And to be honest, I'm trying to think of any changes she gave me that would have changed any of the stories hugely. And I'm thinking there weren't. You know, I think they were mostly down to full stops and commas, you know, where my grammar kind of eluded me. And there was one bit where she thought there was a few words that were like a little over the age bracket. Because the Big Break Detective's age, or it's basically aimed at national school kids. So that's kids from, say, 6 to 12. And I'd say any older than 12, they'd be going, well, I'm in secondary school now. What am I reading about these kids for? So I'd say that's kind of where it is. But I kind of made the language sophisticated as well. Because I think it's important not to talk down to kids, you know, or patronise them, because I have kids and they can spot when dad's trying to be cool. So I try not to be cool and just let it flow out. So I'm trying not to talk down to them in it. But I think there was a couple of words there that she said, oh, 7-year-old would never understand what that was. And I looked at it and it was like obtuse or something.
Right,
I was going,
yeah.
Actually, you know what? You're actually right. So I changed.
Yeah.
On The Murder Can Be Fatal, Helen Carr is my editor on that, on the whole series. And she's just been fantastic. I mean, the first book went fairly much without a hitch. Again, like there was a few spellings and a few bits of grammar and so on. But I don't think she really demanded any huge changes to it. On the second book, she was fantastic because that's the time travel one. And she was completely called my bluff on a few things that, you know, would have ended up in gaping plot holes as opposed to little plot holes over it. You know? But she was great on that because that was, you know, you can screw up your mind trying to think of time travel, you know. If you watched Doctor Who recently, you know, it's hard to even watch and figure out what the hell's happening.
Yeah, it really is.
You imagine Stephen Moffat or whoever writing these stories, like, they must be... Their heads must be wrecked.
Yeah, just even to come to some sort of even, you know, something that we might believe.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
Like vaguely, even though we, you know, not going to invest entirely in it.
But. Well, I think any book is a suspension of disbelief. Yeah. But I think you're right. It has to be grounded in some sort of logic. Mm. Even if it's like the kind of logic that only works internally in the book.
Yeah,
it has to
yeah.
follow logic. And you can't be going off on totally different, you know... roller coaster rides in the opposite direction to what actually should be happening there. So yeah, she's been great on that, and we're working. I'm writing the third book at the moment, which is going great. I'm going to have it the basic storyline done by the end of the month, and then I'll sit down. How it works is I'll sit down with Helen when we'll read through the storyline together, basically, and she'll say, "Well, you know. Have you ever heard of a Confederate, you know, doing this or whatever?" And I'll go, yeah, you're right, and I'll take a note, and then I'll go home and change it. I'm not, I mean, I'm a control freak, but I'm not overly precious about myself. Yeah. And if somebody, you know, says something that makes absolute sense to me, I won't fight against it, you know, tooth and nail. Yeah. So, yeah, they've been absolutely fantastic with me, I have to say. And I'm very encouraging and positive from day one. Mm. You know, so I'm delighted the whole enterprise as such, the whole relationship has been great with
them. So, how long, what's the period of time that these books are going to come? Like, when is, certainly on the books that are, you know, agreed on, like now, or, you know, set to come out, like, so how, between now and when will they all be out?
Well, the next two books, The Big Brave Detectives and 6 Million Ways to Die, are out on Monday week, which is the 26th of September. That's their release date. They'll probably be in the shops a bit earlier than that, which means this week, so dying to see them. But the other books I'm working on, there is Destination Homicide is going to be a spring release. So I would say March, April next year, it should be in the shops. The fourth one, And the Blood Ran Green, is due for a late September release next year. So they kind of coincide with the school year. I mean, in a way, they're not aimed primarily at school kids, but you kind of have to follow the school year in this because so many people are on holidays. And, you launch something in the summer, it's kind of silly season, nobody notices. Yeah. So you kind of wait until everybody's back home and focused. As well as that, you know, schools are a great way of getting the word around on these things. You know, it's almost like the internet for preteens who aren't on Twitter and aren't on Facebook. They're going to be talking about it in the yard, you know, like we did when we were kids before the bloody internet reared its ugly heads. So it's kind of handy to have that kind of net, almost like a networking opportunity, especially where kids' books are concerned. So that's what's happening next year. I'm also going to try and squeeze in Finch's 15 at some stage next year. Now, I'd like to do that and have that ready for the autumn as well. But it'll all depend on, you know, how much I can get done.
I need to
pick up the slack. I need to get my finger up. I've only 3 books out this year, so I need to get working on it.
Well, I mean, it must be great, like, to be able to know that, like, you know, up until the end of next year that you have, like, comics coming out, like, well, consistently.
It's fantastic because when you're self-publishing, like, you're under a little bit of pressure from yourself and from whoever else is involved in the comic when you're self-publishing. We found this with Sancho. I was editing Sancho basically by myself with a bit of input from Ian from the creative end. Ian Whelan's the co-writer of Sancho. And then we got a lot of collaborators in. But really, it's kind of, if a collaborator was 2 months late, we go, you're grand. You know, if we have it out for, you know, next year, we'd be all right. We kind of planned our releases around trade shows, or not trade shows, but, you know, comic cons and conventions that were coming up. So we'd know that we were booked into the Bristol convention in May. So we'd start working on it, you know, in the August beforehand, we'd start planning it and get it so we'd have our 500 or 600 copies of the comic ready to go for May. But that kind of, due to several things, myself being made redundant from the job that I was in and having to go out and set up my own business, which I've done in the last couple of years, it kind of, you know, I was working long hours trying to start that up to start with. So that kind of put Sancho on the back burner. But having said that, being made redundant was probably the best thing that ever happened, because I wouldn't be doing these books. You know, it's the kind of thing, you know, I did the odd illustration when I was working in a, for another company as an Ixer or whatever. But they're the kind of thing, you know, you'd almost be afraid to sign it in case your old boss would see it and go, no loan, stand in front of me and explain why you're, you know. So it was kind of, and I actually actively pursued the illustration thing when I was out on my own, and I was able to get the work with the Irish Times, which was great because that got me the work with O'Brien's, and it's all been gone. I mean, this is what I love doing. I love drawing and I love making up stories and I love writing, and I actually prefer writing to drawing at the moment, but only because of a sore hand. But it's so I'm really, really enjoying it, I have to say. It's a great kick.
And finally then, just what advice, just saying, you know, setting up your own business and especially for illustrators going out there and trying to get work in this climate. And like, what are your views on a lot of illustrators kind of have said to me about the dilemma between working for free or not, you know, in some, you know, to get their work out there versus, you know, actually being paid?
Well, I have to say, I actually have to be paid because I have three kids. So I don't do a hell of a lot of work for free. Having said that, I do a lot of stuff for small press. Mm. But if, you know, and that's grand. And I love doing that. And I do that for free any day. But for established places like the Irish Times or, stuff like that, you just have to, you know, I'm not a great fan of, although, you know, it's the whole Bill Cullen thing, you know, about going out, get out and work, and you get nowhere without experience on it. But you also get nowhere if you're not getting a few bob for it either, you know, and you have to value your work as well. I've been quite lucky now that I haven't, with any of the illustration work I've done, that's been paid, I haven't actually had to do it. It's just kind of fallen in my lap between because small jobs I do for people and then they'd refer me on to somebody else and then I'm referred on to somebody in the Irish Times who's seen a cartoon somewhere and or a cartoon that's been passed on to them. And then, you know, it's, I'm not saying you're, I can't see myself ever making a living from illustration or books unless they take off in a huge way, which would be fantastic, but I can't see myself making, you know, enough money to live on. But having said that, I do enjoy the whole graphic design end of it as well. So, I mean, I've designed these books as well, you know, from start to finish and did the front cover, back cover, inside, you know, the whole, all the copyright pages, all that kind of stuff was all done by myself and laid out and given to O'Brien's as artwork. I just love doing that end of things nearly as much as I love drawing and writing the books. So it's kind of, I'm happy doing what I'm doing.
I've read a lot of interviews with different types of people from like filmmakers and that who really do enjoy, you know, making the actual thing, say the film or the comic or whatever, but also really have a hand in, say, you know, like the marketing, the packaging of, you know, and how it's presented to people, because you can really, you know, convey your entire, you just give it your own bring your look.
Yeah, it's like the whole concept, you know, is done. Yeah, I like that kind of stuff. Now, I'm on top of the marketing that they're doing in O'Brien's, like they're passing stuff by me and I'm saying, yeah, that's brilliant, and so on. And, you know, they're really good in there at that sort of thing. So I'm kind of leaving a lot of that up to them, but they do show it to me, you know. For instance, on the Big Break Detectives, they're doing a range of fridge magnets, which I just think is brilliant. I presume these are going to be freebies. but they're really good. Like, that's if you look in the inside here, where I have the ham and pickle moustache kit, I got a call last week or an email from Donna, who does their marketing, saying, "Can we have that moustache by itself?" And I've actually done a fridge magnet that's in the shape of a moustache. I got back to her and said, "That's brilliant! It's like Freddie Mercury, you know? It's just fantastic." You're looking at it going, "It's kind of magic." It's just fantastic.
That's brilliant. Sounds really like the kind of thing, like in a couple of years' time, you'd be looking at these books and the crazy merchandise that came out with them.
Either that, or you'd be looking at your fridge and saying, "There's a big black slug crawling across." What the hell?
Well, Alan Owen, thanks very much for taking the time to talk to us. Welcome. And I'm sure we'll be talking to you soon about the next 10 books that you'll be doing.
Absolutely. Well, I look forward to it.
Welcome. We're back. Welcome back. That was Alan Owen. He's got some books out, which he discussed in the interview.
Yeah.
Why don't you recap that information for me?
they're available in all good bookshops. Check it out on the O'Brien Press website and Alan Nolan's personal website, all linked up underneath this post.
Excellent. Is there anything else you want to talk about before we go?
No, but I'd be happy to talk about anything you wish to talk about.
How about the life and times of Elizabeth Hurley?
Elizabeth Hurley. I actually, you know what? It's been so long since I heard anyone mention her name. I had to actually just pause and remember who she was.
Yeah, exactly. She used to be married to Hugh Grant.
Yeah, I remember now. And you know what? I've seen now that, yeah, now it's coming back to me. I think I've seen a photo of her recently with her recent husband who she has forced to go to like plastic surgeons, and he looks really weird. He looks like David Guest.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
That's pretty amazing.
Yeah. Well, you asked to talk about it. So.
Yeah. I thought it was going to be a no-go, but you just dropped some crazy, crazy interesting facts there. So I think we should quit while we're ahead.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely.
And leave for that one. Leave it for the next podcast.
Leave it for our Elizabeth Hurley podcast.
I forgot last time we were meant to have what's her name? You hate her. She plays Catwoman in the upcoming Batman.
Oh, Anne Hathaway.
We're meant to have an Anne Hathaway special, so I think we'll have that in 2 weeks, where we go through every Anne Hathaway movie and comment on it. I know you'll have negative comments out of slightly more positive comments, I think. So that'll be a feature in 2 weeks. Also, we'll be reviewing some comics. So tune in.
And I should point out that we won't be doing it over Skype. It'll sound much better than this pile of shit.
Yeah, absolutely. Unless it rains. In which case, <course. laughs> the whole thing could absolutely be done via Skype. Okay, I'll see you in 2 weeks, Liam. And I'll also see you listeners in 2 weeks.
End call.